The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson and my guest this week is comedian, musician and one third of musical comedy legends tripod, Stephen Gatesy Gates. Welcome to FOFOP.
It is such an honour, finally, to be asked as part of your wonderful podcast, Charlie Clawson. Thank you.
Gatesy, I'm really excited to get you in particular onto the show this week because what I want to talk about is the fantastic three-part Beatles documentary Get Back that is screening on Disney Plus. I just finished it last week and you and I have been texting back and forth. And I want to talk to you in particular about it, A, because you're a fantastic musician and I am not very musically inclined, so I have some questions for you. But also as someone who makes their living in a musical group where you have to collaborate and balance out, you know, different influences and things like that to get your perspective on the creative process. But before we get into all of that, tell me, what is your relationship with the Beatles? How did you discover them?
Charlie, before I even answer that question, can I just to hold you up there?
Yeah.
Because I get that a lot with, especially in adult life. Somehow, because I make music for a living, suddenly I have some sort of better or hidden knowledge on the industry and music in general. Now, I used to think that when I was a teenager, like dragging around a guitar because I knew a couple of chords. I thought I knew more about music and had a better opinion, a firmer views of music than other people. But really, just because you know, don't really play music or that doesn't, shouldn't prevent you from having firm views on things. I mean, You're no less qualified to have opinions about the Beatles Get Back special as I do, you know, and I do extend that to anyone out there going, oh yeah, I don't know much about music, so you know, I'll defer to someone who does. Never do that. It's like just because you don't play football doesn't mean you don't have firm views about footy.
Well, the Beatles, I guess, are an exception beyond any other band, probably beyond any other musical documentary, because they are such a pop culture phenomenon. I mean, they are a band.
Absolutely.
But they're more than that, aren't they? Like, they are kind of like, they're movie stars, they are a merchandise phenomenon. They're just sort of woven into the DNA of Western culture. And so everyone, they'd probably be the most recognizable pop stars in the world. Them and, you know, Michael Jackson or Madonna, probably. But even beyond that, their music is so well known and like even non-fans would know at least a dozen Beatles songs because they were so prolific and so successful.
Mm. And such a huge, broad spectrum of genres they love to inhabit. And they were such sort of filters of 20th century music and 20th century culture, really. Like they extraordinary reimaginers. Why not?
Interpreters.
That's great. Good on you. See. I know a few chords, but you know words. The whole debate about Beatles versus
Lennon, McCartney,
Rolling
Clawson, Gates. You write the chords. Yeah. I'll write the lyrics.
love it. But I love the, you know, I have friends who won't even watch the thing because they hate the Beatles or, you know, they're more Rolling Stones fans, which is a really interesting. I mean, that whole sort of Blur versus Oasis, we need to have a common enemy, or, you know. But for me, Rolling Stones are an incredible blues band. Like, they're a great blues rock and roll band who really stuck to being Rolling Stones, sex, drugs, rock and roll and everything. But the Beatles, to me, were just so much more expansive, and there's, when people say they hate the Beatles, I think they're thinking of a certain time or maybe a certain, because every album is different. Like, as you said, they really go from And I mean, that was pretty much due, I think, to John Lennon and McCartney just trying to impress each other and outdo each other on a songwriting level. You know, McCartney's scream, when he screams in a rock voice, he's emulating Lennon, I believe. This is my opinion.
Right.
And, you know, when Lennon's trying to write some more melodic, less catchy or I should say simple. Like Lennon was great at just making these simple kind of statements and repeating them. You know, all you need is love. You know, I just believe that's Lennon straight up, you know. But
it is funny when you hear that criticism of, you know, I hate the Beatles. I saw someone put something online which is like, oh, God damn it, like another Beatles documentary. When's there going to be a James Brown documentary?
I saw that too.
Different forms of music. And I'm like, well, one genius does not negate another genius. No. Like, they can both exist.
But also, I disagreed with that comment only because the Beatles, even though they're at the forefront of so many things, they took advantage of all the technology. They were big tech nerds. They took advantage of all of it at the beginning.
Yeah.
They didn't really, I don't believe that they were very original. They were incredible sponges of everything, of all music that surrounded them. And, yeah, James Brown invented stuff. He created things. He originated certain genres even. Like, so for me, it's kind of like they're incomparable, you know? Like, yeah, it's a toughie. That, I mean, I remember I'm talking to Jon and Scott, the guys I work with in Tripod, and Jon and I are banging on about this Beatles Get Back, and we ask Scott, "Have you seen it, Scott?" And he goes, there's only so long I can sit in a room with a bunch of white guys hearing them talk about music, and I went, because I have trouble taking compliments, Charlie. So I'm just trying to take everything as a compliment nowadays. And I just went, yeah, Scott, that's the most beautiful thing you've ever said. To compare Tripod to the Beatles, mate, that's just made my day. I'm sure that's not what he meant. But I took it that way, which is the important bit.
not to lean on it too heavily, but can we get back to the original question?
Yes,
which was, so how did you discover the Beatles?
Well, I was on the, I remember growing up, and, you know, music was everything to me. I didn't really follow sport. I fell asleep with a AM transistor underneath my pillow listening to 3XY, and I just adored music, new music. I was right across the you know, top 40 and things. And so the Beatles represented old stuff to me. And, you know, when you think of the Fab Four, it's the floppy hairs, the floppy hair in the early 60s. I was not across their later albums or their journey as artists or anything. It was my high school sweetheart, beautiful Chloe, who loved the White Album. And she made me a tape of the White Album. And so I'm 17, and I fell in love. I fell in love with every single song. I was amazed by how different each one was and how perfect that song seemed in that genre that was chosen for that song. And, you know, and then I found out that was at a time when they were falling apart as a band, and they were writing, they weren't collaborating as much anymore, and George Harrison's songwriting was coming through, and, you know, and Blackbird is McCartney trying to impress George, I think, you know, like, and he comes out with another stunning song, and it just, so I was introduced to the Beatles through the White Album, and then I was given, a few years later, from my stepdad's shed, a box set of vinyl of the entire Beatles collection.
Wow. Which, you still have it?
Yeah, yeah. And it was it wasn't his to give me, it was his son's. So thank you, Scott. And I shall return it
to your cousin.
Yeah. I shall return it, Scott, at some stage. But
I have spoken to Scott about it. He's the one that owns the box set that I now have. And that was incredible. So then you get to really, you know, sit down with the album and try to enjoy it as one did back in the time. And and then you go, oh, Abbey Road's my favourite album. And then discover that Abbey Road was their last real album, you know. Mm. So, there's too much in there, just like the special. There's too much in the records and the songs.
Yeah, it is almost too much to take in one go. And it makes sense that you sort of drift away from the Beatles and come back to them because, like you say, they went through so many iterations themselves. Mm. I mean, personally, for me, you know, I'm the youngest of a big family, and so, you know, we had like a wall filled with vinyl. And I remember finding the Sgt. Pepper's album, and I think it was one of the first albums where they printed the lyrics out. And yeah. I remember like just looking at that artwork on the front and then reading on the back, and because I was, you know, 5 or 6 at the time, thinking it was a kid for kids because it you know, had a kind of look and feel of a kid's story. You know, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band sounds like a kid's story. And then listening to the music and playing with the left-right speaker and realizing that I could phase the vocals down or just the music and sort of really... It was so different to anything else that I was finding, you know, my brother's Jethro Tull or, my sister's disco albums or anything else that I was finding. It just seemed so weird. And then I kind of, I guess, you know, early teens drifted away and got more into metal and like most teen boys do.
Mm.
And then I sort of came back to it again towards the end of high school, mainly through John Lennon. That documentary Imagine had been out for a few years and I watched that. And then I started reading a bunch of books on John Lennon and just became really fascinated by him. Yeah. I just thought he was such an interesting personality, art school dropout, you know, the time in Hamburg and how he tried to get his best mate to be their bass player, Stewie Sutcliffe. And then, you know, the whole getting his girlfriend pregnant, Cynthia, and having Julian, but then discovering their love is his life, this avant-garde artist. And then the way he left the Beatles and this kind of, you know, love-hate relationship with Paul. And I just found that all so fascinating. And I remember I just sort of consumed all the albums. And I think for me, like my favorite album of theirs is Revolver.
Yeah.
To me, that feels like their first real breakaway from pop.
Yes.
Totally. Like Rubber Soul's great, but it's still got like Drive My Car and that. But then Revolver is just like, it's got Tomorrow Never Knows. And you listen to the end of that album and it's like, ooh.
Yeah.
It's like an after credit sequence in a Marvel film. You're like, what's fucking coming next?
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're heading into, and I guess that would have been around about when they stopped touring, when they recorded that album, because it's so layered with production. And like you said, they're tech nerds, so they're experimenting with playing tracks backwards and just layering. And it was so fascinating. But then I guess, you know, I bought all their albums. I had the Beatles box set, the CDs, which I tried to offload on Gumtree, but surprisingly enough, people aren't wanting to buy CDs anymore.
They're coming back, baby. They're coming back. Don't worry.
But then, you know, I hadn't really thought about them too much. And, you know, Jem, she can take or leave the Beatles. She, coming from the UK, she was one of those people who's like, they're overexposed. I just associate them with, like, advertising and holiday music or whatever.
Thanks to Michael Jackson.
But when we sat down to watch it, like, she was blown away. Like, I mean, we've all been listening to in the last 2 weeks in this house now is Beatles because I think she just got a whole new appreciation for, because she was asking me a lot of questions too, like, all right, well, who wrote this song and who wrote that song and, you know, what stage are they at here? And so I was sort of giving it, as we were going, giving this sort of commentary, sort of updating on, you know, where they'd been to this point, when they'd stopped touring, all this kind of stuff, because it does inform so much of what goes into that documentary. Like, I think you can watch it cold, not knowing any history. But if you do know the history, it's so rich.
I think there's two kinds of people too, Charlie. There's people who love eating the sausage and they want to know how that sausage is made and they love all the everything that goes into making that sausage. And then there are the other kind of person that just likes eating the sausage. They just want the sausage and they're not interested. And I think I think the majority of people just want to eat the sausage. But I think in terms of art and creating, making shit out of absolutely nothing, It's such a beautiful meditation on that. I mean, it's freaking 8 hours, listeners. Yeah. If you haven't seen it yet, it's cut down from 150 hours of audio and 60 hours of video and all that of film. And it's a huge watch, but you are a fly on the wall at one of the most compelling groups of the 20th century making art. And why wouldn't that be? Why wouldn't that be compelling to someone who does it themselves?
You feel like you know them. I mean, that's. I said to Jem, like when we had one episode to go, we're driving home. We're really excited about watching it, and I said, I can't wait to hang out with my friends, John, Paul, George, and Ringo, it's so intimate.
I've had the
For people who haven't seen it, the way that Peter Jackson has structured it, it's not like your normal documentary where it's talking heads and narration where they fill in the gaps. It's almost like reading quite a dense novel.
Yes.
You literally are just observing the creative process with these four mega famous kind of dudes. But it's not full of kind of dramatic moments. It's quite mundane a lot of times. I mean, it's got the music of the Beatles to carry it through. Well, not just the Beatles, like they do a lot of covers as well.
Incredible soundtrack.
Yeah, incredible. But it's kind of, it requires concentration because you are having to kind of, A, there's the Liverpudlian accent, which can be, you know, quite thick at times. But also there's so much nuance to the interactions. Like if you're not noticing that George is getting his back up about the way Paul's talking to him, or if you're not watching, you know, the way that, you know, they're getting shitty with their engineer because he hasn't set the studio up. Like there's all these little things that you have to pay attention to. So it is quite a commitment if you sit down to watch it.
Oh, it's incredibly detailed and layered, and there's so much to notice. If you're just a fan of fashion, like it's just worth watching.
Oh my God. It's amazing. The fashion is so good. And that's the other thing, because the footage that they shot, the 150 hours, was originally shot for the Let It Be concert movie.
Yeah.
So the idea was they were going to shoot this concert movie that was going to culminate in a big TV performance, but they abandoned that idea quite quickly. But they ended up taking some of this footage, which became the Let It Be movie, which was shot in 16, so it's very grainy and desaturated. And I remember seeing it like over 20 years ago, and it was, I find it kind of depressing. It's a really melancholy kind of film because, A, you know the Beatles are going to break up, but they seem to just select like the worst stuff, like where they're bickering. And
you know, there's even Michael Lindsay Hogg, the guy who made Let It Be, and he's the director on the set for this. There's a moment where he says, "Well, it's a good documentary if you let it be like warts and all. Otherwise, it's a bunch of people just picking their nose and sort of bickering, you know." And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But what Peter Jackson managed to get from that, and what my takeaway is, and why you're so excited driving home to watch the next episode, is that there's so much joy in that. You are seeing four friends who, have only been in a band for, you know, 10 to 12 years together. So just seeing them joke around and always engage with the music first, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I've had it on while I'm just pottering around the house because I just I can imagine, therefore, that I'm some Beatles hanger-on back in the day, you know.
You're just like, in the studio with them.
How's that? I just wrote down like 10 minutes of action from the thing.
Go for it.
If you've not seen it, I just for me, it sets up the entire situation in such a beautiful way. He's done such a great job. But the first 10 minutes, of course, is a background of the Beatles. You know, we all know that, you know, all the innovations they did, the fact they walked around from live to basically concentrate on studio recording. But then it opens with a man sweeping the studio floor. I mean, what a great opening, you know, we're ready. And then George and John, with Yoko by John's side, they fumble through an early version of Jealous Guy.
Mm.
And it was originally called On the Road to Marrakesh, which was a lighter, much a prettier kind of idea than what Jealous Guy ended up being. And then Ringo arrives. They got to write and rehearse 14 songs for a TV special in 2 weeks. They're the stakes. We're in. Like, if you don't even care about music, that's the timeline. He uses the calendar as a, you know, as a really simple way of. Then all three of them fumble through an early version of "Don't Let Me Down," and McCartney arrives. Now, is McCartney late, or were the others early? Like, or then John Lennon screams into the microphone, "Don't Let Me Down," as Paul picks up a bass. And in that moment, I'm thinking, oh, passive aggressiveness has already set in. And then they complain about the acoustics. Fair enough, it's a huge film studio. Lennon asks about George's hanger-on, the Hare Krishna guy that sits in the corner, and goes, that's a bit weird, isn't it? Meanwhile, Yoko Ono's sitting by his side. Like, the contradiction there is ridiculous. Michael Lindsay asks them to turn their amps down because the mics are having trouble picking up their conversation. And George goes, oh, are you recording our conversation? And that for me is the setup for the next 7.5 hours of the stakes are perfect. The relationships are set in. And, you know, we lose our minds watching, you know, a bunch of, you know, malignant narcissist on a show called Succession, and who they've basically at one level, but this is real, and the acting couldn't be any. The script is perfect. The delivery is amazing, and I just find it far more a compelling. Of course, it's real, but
well, it's the dynamics. Like, you couldn't cast it any better. Like, you know, you sort of think about any great sort of film or television show, the casting is always spot on. And the casting in this is brilliant. Like, the personalities of all four of the lead cast. And then the supporting cast are great as well.
Yeah.
Like, the director, what is his name? Is Michael something Hogg?
Michael Lindsay Hogg, his name is.
Michael Lindsay Hogg. Like, I find him so funny. And the way he's so, like... you know, softly but persistently pushing the idea that they should fly to Egypt, or is it Libya, to perform in the amphitheatre.
It's so heartbreaking because, you like, as we know, in a brainstorming situation, you know, you're trying to go, no ideas are bad ideas. But he seems to continually produce bad ideas, and which leave the four, the awesome foursome, like, look at each other in a, that's not going to happen. We're not going to do that. And it is about pleasing each other. They're going, oh, what does McCartney think? No one's actually talking to each other about these ideas. Yeah. But through every bad idea that, like, Michael Lindsay Hogg presents, it makes them go further into shaping what it is they end up doing. So you've got to have the bad ideas in order to get the good ideas, which, you know, of course, the end is their rooftop concert, you know.
Yeah, and that's the other thing too, isn't it? It's really about the creative process. Yeah. Like, that's the most kind of enlightening thing, is that, oh, shit, like, they really just start from the bottom, like all of this.
Yes.
And a lot of their creative process is fucking around. There is so much fucking around in this documentary. So much as mucking around, playing other people's music, playing their songs, but changing the lyrics to stupid lyrics, just like having fun. And I'm like, I wonder how much that is, like, is that something they have arrived at? Is that something that they've always done? Like, I read a lot about their time in Hamburg, and, you know, they're taking a lot of amphetamines and performing most nights, and really, you know, they all think that kind of time over there was what really sort of bonded them as a band and just sort of gave them that kind of that work ethic and that repertoire of skills, is they just had to play these for hours and hours, sometimes two shows a night.
Yeah.
And then you sort of see them in the studio, and it's like, oh, and they often reference Hamburg as well. Did you notice that they often talked about, oh, that was like when we were playing in Hamburg, they bring in Billy Preston because they used to play with him in Hamburg, or he used to play, you know, shows alongside them there. And so there is this kind of idea that for them, the creative process isn't like, well, you know, George, you know, John writes the lyrics and Paul comes up with the melody. It's really this back and forth and reaching dead ends so often. Like, it's really interesting with, is it Get Back, where Paul is trying to is talking to George about, like, I think when you do your solo, like, let's not do something that's too predictable. And he's gently trying to guide George in a direction of playing a riff that, and George is sort of getting his back up because he's sort of taking the criticism to heart. And I'm like, first of all, like, my impression of Paul before I watched this documentary was, in a weird way, I think he was my least favorite Beatle. I think I sort of always saw him as kind of the cheesiest one. Mm-hmm. All of his songs were that kind of, like, you know, obla-dee, obla-da, that kind of bright and cheery stuff. And now, having watched the documentary, I'm like, oh, fuck, if it wasn't for Paul. Like, if Paul wasn't there, like, managing the situation and really trying hard to kind of accommodate everybody's egos and sensitivities and stuff. Like, he's the negotiator in that situation.
Paul is the biggest Beatles fan in the world at this point in time. It's, you know, shortly followed by Ringo. I think they truly love this band and this opportunity. And Paul, yeah, I totally agree. I was never, you know, Lennon or Die kind of. Like, always struck me as a kind of a, you know, borderline personality disorder, crazy, freaking, you know, like, needy, so many issues, so angry, rageful, you know, unable to manage his emotions. But in many ways, he was sort of the most unique or original writer of the four, with the most interest, for mine, most interesting ideas. But Paul was such a melody mathematician, almost a scientist. He would bring in influences from vaudeville and, you know, cheesy. But when all they're needing to do is make songs, you know, okay, what's a good song? I think only they really know. But there was no agenda on how or what kind of music. There was a moment when George Harrison brings in I Me My and it's a waltz. And John Lennon goes, oh, what are we having a waltz for? You know, we're a rock band. And mockingly starts dancing with Yoko on the studio floor while they're sort of jamming out I Me My. But I find that just through passive aggression and mocking and making fun, which John Lennon does, he brings out the best in them as well, like, almost despite each other and things.
Well, he's the big brother. Like, he's him and Ringo are the two oldest ones.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a level of Paul looking up to John and George looking up to both of them, but at the same sense that they need to break free from that kind of, you know, older brother figure and stand up for themselves. And it's interesting, there is that there's that conversation between George Martin and the Apple executives about how is the dynamic between John and Paul. And it's like, well, you know, they actually don't write together that often anymore, but this seems to be the kind of the best they've been in a while. And I think that there is something to do with the conflict is what makes the best, like, you know, that they, you know, they can't, they have enough respect for each other musically that they don't, you know, they don't think that the other one can't write or can't come up with a melody or anything like that, but they demand, you know, excellence of each other.
Well,
you know?
Certainly Paul is at this point in time. And going back to what you said about, you know, they reference
26, by the way.
Sorry,
26. He was 26 when this was made.
I don't really want to discuss that part at all. You know, just the idea that, you know, in that first 10 minutes of the thing, you're talking about, you know, John asks Paul, a 14-year-old Paul or 15-year-old Paul, to join the Quarrymen. And go, they're already, you know, activated or actively involved in music, and they've decided this is what they want to do, you know, and they're writing songs at a huge rate, and they just think songwriting is what, doesn't everyone write songs? I don't, all that. But but when they reference Hamburg and their approach to the whole Let It Be album was to go back to basics, it's almost like, they've proven themselves to be incredible, you know, technicians of production and recording and stuff, but now they're sort of returning back to keep it simple, and which I really admire. And but also they're like bookends. The foreshadowing of you can see that they're at the end, you know, at the end of at the end of the band. The band is done. And so what's the easiest way? Well, let's just put together a bunch of songs that we can play live. And you know, and then you just marvel at their arrangement chops and, you know, how, and Paul especially, who's pushing further. I mean, we know in a collaborative scenario, Charlie, no one works at the same speed. So if you've got if you've got your head up and you've already thought, you know, 20 minutes into the future of what you need because you know it, and you're trying to articulate and explain that to your other band members or collaborators, and they're not catching up to you, that's very frustrating. And I'm sure at the age of 26 and being a musical freaking genius as McCartney is at that particular, like, that's peak McCartney. Like,
yeah, right.
when he's playing, speaking words, let it be, you know, let it be.
Yeah.
And the other two, George and John, are waiting to enter, waiting for their moment to sing backups. And you see John Lennon mug the camera and, you know, mockingly sing, mouth the words, let it be. Like, everyone in the room knows that this is an incredible song. And wow, McCartney is on fire. But no one is able to go, wow, that's a great song, Paul. You know, no one says
they can't
because that would go, oh, I mean, certainly Lennon, who, you know, wasn't doing much in terms of, you know, Beatles work at that stage. They all had their minds on the future, you know.
Yeah.
And sadly for Ringo, who's such a beautiful presence on that studio set. Yeah, he's got a lot to lose without the Beatles, you know.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because it feels like the way the documentary is structured, like the first episode is they're just not getting anywhere. You know, there's conflict. Yeah. They're sort of just noodling around. But then somewhere around the second episode, when things start to click, it fucking soars. Oh, like,
it's Billy Preston. It's that moment. And, you know, we all behave when there's an outsider walking into the room.
Yeah.
You know.
But they obviously all respect him as well. Like, it's amazing. I mean, you talk about Ringo having so much to lose. Poor Billy Preston. I mean, there's John going, I think he might be the fifth Beatle. And then it's like, no, they're going to break up. Like, Billy Preston must have been going, fuck, if I just play my cards right, keep my head down, just, like, keep noodling away on the keyboard, maybe I can be the fifth Beatle.
But he brings so much. He fills in those gaps that you didn't know needed filling, you know, or certainly they didn't know. I remember, like, just before he's introduced, John Lennon, he goes, it's my turn on the piano. And, you know, he's there, and then McCartney's over his Lennon's shoulder, you know, hammering out the chords that he's hearing. You know, that when you're going peak McCartney and McCartney's trying to basically direct every note, because he hears the arrangement already, his ability to hear things is remarkable. Like, he can play all the instruments anyway. When he's he's telling Ringo, which I so felt for Ringo at that point, because Ringo just wasn't getting it at one point. He wasn't understanding what Paul was wanting, and has to, instead of, you know, cracking it and going, I'm leaving the band, like, you know, Harrison, he just leaves the room. He just exits and sits in the studio, and then cutting to Paul on the drums, just trying to, don't do that. Don't. Everyone just have lunch. Everyone take a break. You know.
Oh, my God. So many cups of tea and plates of toast. Yeah. It's like, after we watched it, Jem's like, let's get one of those little toast servers. Those little stainless steel toast servers. They're so cute. It's like just so many cups of tea. Do you think at any stage they were high?
Oh, yes.
I felt there were some scenes where they were either just really tired, or I reckon they were high. They were either high on weed or high on acid. But there was one scene where they're noodling around and just, like, jamming and stuff like that. And Paul's eyes just look so glassy.
It's a moment where I think John Lennon refers it to Daddy's tea, and they've got little cups.
Oh, yeah. Is that where Ringo's on the floor, like sitting down with the tea pot?
I believe. I think so. I think we're talking about the same moment. But there, I think it's. Yeah, right. I think it's they're tripping. They're just having such an amazing time, and they're making some pretty awful music at that moment, but loving it. You know, it's that.
Yeah,
that's the thing.
But that's necessary, right? Don't you feel like it, that kind of stuff is necessary for them to get to what will be the good music? Like, that's what I mean about there's so much stuff where, you know, they're playing a Bob Dylan song or they're playing an old blues standard or whatever. And even I thought it was so heartwarming. I don't know which episode it was, but where it's Paul, John and Yoko just rocking out, and Yoko's like shrieking into the microphone. And it's so funny too because it's so contrary to what we've been sold about that relationship. Oh, you know,
yeah,
the idea
absolutely.
That Yoko was the problem. But there's that scene where, you know, the band's all fractured and Ringo and Paul are the only ones to turn up and they're asking
and
Paul what he thinks
two.
About John and Yoko. Yeah. But he's like, it's the first time that John's been in love. Like, yeah. I think, you know, you can't sort of hold that against him. It's a good thing. It's like there's... This is not Paul McCartney revisionist history defending John and Yoko now.
No.
That was John in the shit when the album was on the line and he still refused to pot Yoko. I mean, I think that says everything.
But also, I've got to keep in mind, and I think we all sort of like, all matter behaves differently when observed, right? So they know the cameras are on them. They know all of that. And I think Paul is a very masterful like manipulator of media. I mean, he's got great ideas. He knows he's, and I'm not saying he's being disingenuous or dishonest. I'm just going, maybe there are other levels that, which is revealed in the conversation with the hidden microphone in the flower pot.
Yeah. Oh, how amazing is that scene? So describe that.
So, well, George leaves. George has had enough. He goes, you know, I'll see you around the clubs.
That's right.
The rest of the afternoon is, you know, the band not quite knowing what to do with themselves. They don't know how to, like Ringo's left before. Ringo's done it a couple of years ago, I think. And so it's happened before. But that's when they're all kind of getting loose on the instruments. Yoko's on the microphone screaming. It's all they're like letting out some sort of strange pent up aggression and letting it and taking it out on the instruments and things. But they go to George's house over the weekend, and it apparently gets worse, and Yoko does a lot of the talking for John, and it's revealed that George is just having a bit of a problem with the creative process and all the hangers-on and all the people around. But
yeah.
The flower pot. So there's a hidden microphone on a table. I don't know how they did it. Like, I mean, it's so odd. And the technology they used apparently to get the audio from that microphone was not available in the 60s and 70s. But it's a beautiful, sincere conversation between John and Paul about what they're doing and how they manage their relationship.
So they don't know that they're being recorded.
They don't know they're being recorded.
It's basically John explaining to Paul what George is feeling, why George doesn't want to come back to the band.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's a whole lot of deflection in that conversation where, well, you know, Paul's saying, John, you've always been the boss and, you know, now I feel like I'm sort of having to take the reins, which is fair enough because John's pinned all the time, you know. John's having a great time. apparently he was pretty into the heroin at that point in time. But
is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's why I feel like John...
Is that why Yoko's just sitting there quietly the whole time?
They're just there, yeah. And...
Fucking hell. I mean, imagine, not necessarily heroin, but imagine being high and just sitting in on a session with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, just as a little side note, watching that and then seeing that, this is going to sound like a massive tangent, but just stay with me.
Yeah.
Watching that and then seeing that Unreal Engine demo of the new Matrix game, where it looks virtually real life, I was like, they have 150 hours of the Beatles rehearsing. Mm. If there was some virtual reality experience where I could put on a helmet and just sit in on the month-long recording session of Let It Be, and it was just unedited, And maybe it's an algorithm that's sort of filling in the gaps. Like, obviously, they don't have footage for everything. I would fucking do that. I would love.
Say goodbye to like real life, to Jen, Charlie.
Like, I said to Jen, like, there's 8 hours. That means there's 142 hours that I haven't seen. Yeah. I want to see that 142 hours.
Oh, yeah. And I think it has to be said, getting back to that Yoko thing, she really took the hit the 20th century. And a lot of it was steeped in misogyny and racism and things
racism,
like that.
100%.
But I'm sitting there, my housemate lasted 15 minutes in the first episode because he just couldn't stand the presence of this fifth person. And so it was affecting him 50 years later.
Yeah.
But
it's funny, I've got friends who had the same complaint. They watched it and they were just like, Yoko, just her presence bugged them so much. They found it really hard to enjoy.
Yeah, but that's, I just don't blame her for that. I blame John for that. John's inability to just manage himself on his own. He needs her by his side the whole time. As you said, he's fallen in love for the first time. And it's in the song.
Don't you know it's going to last?
Gung, 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 gung. Yeah, it's now a waltz. Anyway. But, yeah, that was such a – I had my suspicions, of course, you know, because Yoko's even used as a cultural kind of expression of, I don't mean to Yoko the situation or, you know. It's a shame. It's a shame. But yeah. John needs to pull his head in.
Yeah, well, it's also, I mean, like you said, like George had his Hare Krishnas there, but they're just not on camera.
No.
I mean, I'm sure that was, I mean, it is, now that you mention it, it is kind of ironic that George is like, oh, I'm a bit freaked out by all these people watching us record. It's like, well, you brought two Hare Krishnas to watch us do the album.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, exactly. But they're all managing, having to, this is their full-time job. Being a Beatle is what their job is, and they're recording artists, which that's another thing. It's a real a time capsule of the music industry at that time, which is if you were as big as the Beatles, you could walk away from live performance and just concentrate on the records. And I always loved that idea, even growing up. You know, the idea of not really performing, needing to perform live, but just hiding away in a cabin and making records and making a living from that. And I think those times are definitely gone. You need to work out a way of getting a TikTok presence and all that sort of stuff in order to monetize your art or commodify it. When I just love the purity of making a record and selling that for some bucks. You know, that makes a lot of sense to me still. And even when they're discussing with some guy in the second episode about, you know, the figures and where to get revenue through sheet music and all that stuff. Ringo says to George, do you want to see where your 0.5% has gone? He's only making 0.5% that, you know, and... Which is fair because he didn't write those particular songs and no thanks. You know, they're all sort of fracturing. They're already starting to think beyond the Beatles.
But what you're saying about them, you know, they were just left alone to make these studio albums. Mm. But their journey is not that different to modern music because they were a boy band and they were doing mass publicity. And they, I mean, the film Hard Day's Night is the equivalent of TikTok now. You know, they did the most popular media at the time to kind of get the shit out there. And so they were just so successful and made so much money that they could afford to do that. So I am sure, I mean, that journey does not seem unusual. I know when we were making music videos, for like, you know, major labels and stuff.
Yeah.
Anytime we pitched them something that was a bit arty or whatever, they would always say, look, if this is a debut single, just make it the most commercial, easily digestible thing at the moment. Even Lady Gaga's first single was the most kind of, you know, cookie cutter pop song in terms of the sound and the look and her styling and everything. And then once that's a hit, she can go into Meat Dress and she can get as fucking arty as she like. But I think... That hasn't changed at all.
Oh, no. No, that hasn't changed at all.
I mean, there's also so much stuff, too, in the documentary that you're like, would this have worked if it wasn't the Beatles. Like, I do have a feeling that by the time you get, and, you know, spoilers, if you're unaware that the Beatles played a rooftop concert.
Yeah.
But by the time they get to the rooftop concert, although it's great seeing them playing live, I'm like, this feels underwhelming. Oh, like, I feel like
interesting.
If you were on the street, because people on the streets can't really see them. Yeah. They can sort of hear them. But you know what it's like in London, and especially hearing, you know, it would sound really washed out and a bit clangy. It wouldn't sound like amazing.
It would sound noisy.
So I wasn't necessarily buying. They do a good job of sort of selling the experience because they have like 8 cameras down on the street and, you know, the cop storyline subplot is amazing.
Oh, Debbie at the desk. Oh, so good.
Part of me was just like, could you not have found like a second story apartment so people could have seen you? Because that would have been more of an experience, you know, let the people say goodbye to the Beatles. But this is all retrospect.
But it's all foreshadowed that, in the when they're talking about, well, McCartney says, I'm a bit nervous about performing live, to be honest. I'm a bit nervous about performing in front of people. What they want their cake and eat it too. They want that live moment where, and even they said, we want to do it outside. We need to do it somewhere where we're not supposed to be. You know, they talk about orphanages. We're going to
get arrested in front of Parliament.
Well, yeah, orphanages and stuff gets thrown around. Like, what the hell?
I didn't hear that.
Oh, man, hospitals with sick kids in it. Like, this is the guy that's making the film suggesting all these places. But, and that moment where it's, we could do it on the roof. And Paul's expression is golden. It's like, oh, of course, we can do this. I thought the live performance element on the roof was outstanding. I was overwhelmed. I went, all of their talk about that chord should go there and this snare hit should be here, it's all out the window now, and they've just got to concentrate on performing live. And all of you know, the quietude of John Lennon throughout, until he gets to the frickin' roof, he's the coolest mofo I've ever seen perform. It's like, this is the Beatles, man. They are. Paul is having an absolute ball, you know. Yeah. Each time, and I was really surprised by the fact that you hear "Get Back" 3 times. You know, Peter Jackson wants you to see what that rooftop experience was like. It wasn't a show.
Yeah.
It was filmed for the film. And it was recorded for an album. And some of those takes end up on albums. Like, because there's such an energy to them. It's like, even leading up to that, don't you worry about the performance element. We're the Beatles. I think even McCartney says that, or Lennon says that, we're the Beatles. We'll be able to do that. Like, that's what we're engineered to do. And rightly so. They frickin' blow. Each version of Get Back is slightly different. And there's a magic to one of those takes that wasn't in the previous one. And I found that, I was shocked at the beginning. Are we going to hear Get Back again? But then as that episode progressed, I started getting it, and really, it's something that it's really special. It's a really special thing to see and witness.
Yeah, did you feel that there was an element of, like, with that cop subplot? Because I was like, oh, it's really funny. So what's going on is two Bobbies arrive at the Apple offices because they're getting sound complaints, and they remarkably have this hidden camera like behind a mirror in the foyer.
They know.
So they're getting this really unguarded interactions between the cop and the receptionist, and amazing delay tactics. As someone who's produced many performances and you get a noise complaint, I know exactly the tactic of, yeah, sure, let me just go speak. And so you just take your time going back and forth to the person complaining until you can delay them no longer. But there's this great bit where the sergeant comes to find out where his two constables are because they've gone up onto the roof. And he goes up on the roof and you see Paul playing and he turns around and he's so stoked to see the cops are there because his original idea was, let's get arrested out the front of Parliament.
Yeah, exactly. But that, the delay tactics are perfect, aren't they? I think it's her name's Debbie, the receptionist.
The receptionist.
But she's a genius. It's like, what are they, like, she's going, are they making noise? I have no idea. Like, what? And she's selling it as they're making noise in their rehearsal studio because the cops don't know that they're on the roof. They're, you know, they didn't have drones back then. I found that as a, because we'd seen, you know, the Get Back, the first take and the second take, I loved how Peter Jackson whacked, you know, that narrative through, just to keep the spectators or tourists interested in the narrative, I guess. But it was funny. It was super funny.
Did you know that the songs on Let It Be, some of them were complete live takes? I had no idea.
Yeah, neither did I. Neither did I.
They're flawless. Flawless. They're amazing.
There you go. Like, well, it's just... that's a freaking amazing band. At the height of their powers, and even they were feeling, you know, they're like, you know, in the TV studio when they're rehearsing and trying to jam out ideas and stuff. As you said, they're constantly playing, they're constantly making music, and that's just to get, I guess, to loosen up and get into the groove and all that.
Yeah.
But I have a friend who couldn't stand Ringo's drumming. And I couldn't disagree with him more. He's the greatest listener.
Who couldn't?
A friend of mine, a musician who didn't really like Ringo's drumming through the rehearsals. Mm. But what Ringo's doing is he's just listening so beautifully, just to know when to hit, where to hit. He doesn't want to make it a drum song. And I just like, even his presence is incredible. He is the listener. And when Linda McCartney, well, I think, were they married by then? I don't know.
Linda Eastwood at that stage, I think.
He's marveling at her, you know, her beautiful man, Paul, in the company of Ringo. And she even says, he's so relaxed. Paul's so relaxed around Ringo. And Ringo's just over Paul's shoulder listening while Paul's hammering out, you know, Long and Winding Road. And you feel their friendship so beautifully in that moment. It almost brought a tear to my eye. Yeah. I just loved that moment. And he brings it. Everyone brings it on that rooftop. It's just remarkable.
There are so many moments that are like so highly emotional. And I think it's also too, the idea of seeing the genesis of a song that you know so well, like there were so many times where I was like, oh my God, like this is it. Mm. Like this is the bit where, you know, Paul's playing, like, I've got this idea for a song, and he starts playing the beginnings of Get Back. Even Ringo, you know, doing Octopus's Garden. Yeah. And then George coming over and saying, oh, what if you had a bit of this going on? It's like, oh, my God, that's like the guitar solo from Octopus's Garden. But, like, how rare to see that, to actually see something that you know so well, the actual, like, moment it came into the world. It's so emotional.
I think, I reckon, Charlie, I learnt a shitload just watching, just even about collaboration. Like, I never went to an arts college. I don't even know if they teach collaboration or how to listen to each other, how to yes and all that sort of stuff you learn in time. But where was I going?
Octopus's
Garden.
Octopus,
sorry, the song before that.
Get Back.
Get Back. Oh, that's it. My approach to my own music and art is to edit myself before I've even put pen to page. I'm already criticising myself.
Most and it's my, do that. Yeah.
But watching an artist like McCartney. Whoa!
He'd love that. nice comparison.
He would. Bloody Pauls, they're everywhere. Watching an artist like McCartney push through. He's not editing. He's making sounds with his mouth that will be lyrics one day. And it just... Oh, great. Drilling's begun on the roof.
Okay, that's all right.
There's so much to cover. Charlie, maybe we should do this in four parts, just like Peter Jackson. just, yeah, watching an artist push through and creating in that moment stuff out of nothing, I need to apply that to my and I've been in a group for 25 years now, but I need to apply that to my own art. And just seeing another person, yeah, one of the great songwriters of the 20th century do it, was mind-blowing to me. Even watching them, you know, McCartney, you know, do that thing of try to direct each part and each arrangement. I know not to do that. Like, but so seeing that, seeing the reaction of people and seeing John just sort of close up and George kind of went, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll not play if you want me to not play. You know, you learn just by watching, you know, even that, as to not do that in a collaborative situation. You've got to wait for people to catch up.
It must be so frustrating, though, to be so talented and know exactly what you want and not be able to...
Oh, Charlie, it's so hard. It's just really... No, but it must be. You're looking at peak McCartney. You're watching it all unfold.
Pete McCartney, not only musically, but his style. Yeah. I mean, all of their style is pretty fucking bang on. I mean, there's George, I think at some stage, looks like Willy Wonka. Like, he has this purple shirt, bow tie combo that's like, all right, Willy, back off. But I just love, like, Paul's, I mean, he's so handsome and he's so kind of like strident, and he's got that vest and the beard and the shaggy hair, and watching him do the Paul McCartney head shake, you know, when he's really rocking out, it's just like, oh, he's so cool.
I wouldn't know. Well, only Paul would know what it's like to write Long and Winding Road or Let It Be or all those incredible goddamn songs. I think I would have a little swagger if I'd walked into a studio with an armful of songs like that, you know, like...
But that's the point, isn't it, though?
He could have been much worse.
He didn't, though.
You know, he could have been an absolute nightmare. But he was so full of, again, cameras are rolling. He's being observed. He is so full of humility. He is trying to listen. He's trying to slow down and let the others catch up to him. But at the same time, he knows that there is, and we know as viewers, that there is only 2 weeks to get 14 songs together. And they kind of bail out of that, a whole idea. They bail out of doing a live show and just record and concentrate on the album and get that media opportunity, you know, which is the gig on the roof, which isn't a gig. It's just they're just recording.
Well, they always put despite their own egos and whatever they're feeling, they always seem to put the Beatles first. And I love that. Because I thought by that stage, you know, and especially, you know, the bad taste that had been left in their mouth by, you know, Brian Epstein making them this pop band, they're still very affectionate, you know. And if you read any of the kind of biographies on the Beatles or whatever, they were really mismanaged. Like, even Epstein, for all the good he did, you know, fucked them over contractually. And then Alan Klein and, you know, Apple was set up really improperly. And so they had all this talent and they just, you know... They were always looking for father figures or someone to kind of guide them.
But also push against, you know,
And push against, they needed someone to rebel against. I thought that over the course of the three episodes, you do see this kind of evolution of these songs that would end up going on Let It Be. And there is some sort of subtext to it. And I thought that the two of us, being this song that they're constantly working on, was such a beautiful metaphor for John and Paul, you know, and it's really a song about like this, you know, it's almost a nostalgic about your youth, about just like, you know, not having responsibilities and just doing whatever you want. And I get sort of goosebumps.
Oh,
when
me
I think
too.
About
I'm getting
it
like, now, Charlie, as you talk about it.
Yeah. When they sing it and they really nail it, and it's about episode two, and their harmonies are just perfect. Like, you feel like they could just go from that track into any other song and they would be completely in sync. Like, even Jem, who, again, is not like a huge Beatles fan, like, she was like, this is amazing. Like, their voices fit together so perfectly and they almost have this kind of like psychic connection where wherever the song's going, wherever the intensity of the delivery is going, they just know how to follow each other. And I just, like, that's the song out of all of them. That and Get Back have just been in my head because I always liked Get Back, but I'd never really thought about it.
Me too.
But now that I've seen the way that it was created and Billy's influence on it, like, it's like, oh, this song has just got so many layers. And like, all I can see is at that, you know, that great kind of rolling intro is just John, like, you know, banging his guitar, like tapping his guitar. And it's like, oh, what a, like, if you saw that live, it would just be such a great song to
which
rock out.
Which before you see, as you see that Get Back Men created, like minutes before, they're jamming out Two of Us. And they're playing with, you know, the feel, because they're still struggling to get what Two of Us should sound like. It's called Two of Us, yeah? I'm not getting that wrong, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's dun 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 Two of Us, dun 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 dun. Minutes later, McCartney's using that feel to get to come up with a Get Back thing, which is like, it's so fluid and organic.
Yeah.
But for my favourite Two of Us moment is both McCartney and Lennon looking at each other, staring each other down and singing the song through gritted teeth. And it's like there's so much resentment and pain and almost like hate in that. But as they do it, they're finding their situation so incredibly funny. They make each other laugh like no other people do. You can see their love and friendship as that song ends. And it's such a remarkable moment.
Yeah. Well, I guess the experience of being a Beatle, like literally there's only three other people that are going to understand what you've been through.
It's like any relationship. You know,
As much as they may bug you, like they are, you know, you're bonded for life for that exact reason. And yeah, it's just, I came away from it feeling so kind of like emotional. It's weird. I saw Marc Maron tweet something about, you know, he grew up listening to the Beatles, but after that documentary, he feels like he knows them. And I think it's a similar thing where, yeah, like I've had phases where I was a massive fan and then I've drifted away and come back. But because they are so kind of woven into most of our histories, you know, it sounds like you and I definitely, our childhoods at least, teens. Mm. But you watch this documentary and it's simultaneously you're getting an insight into these guys that, you know, you only knew as these pop culture icons. And you feel like you know them. But at the same time, they're geniuses. Yeah,
that's
so
it.
You're getting to know geniuses.
Objective genius. It really is. And the height of their powers at the age of, what, 27 or, you know, that's, it just,
oh my
let's
God.
Not. But it's
let's not dwell on that part.
But you speak about their huge, you know, breadth of work from the first Beatles album to how many albums we're talking? 10, 12? What? How many? In the space of 8 years, 7 or 8 years. Having a film crew in the studio for Revolver, or that would have been a really lovely time capsule of a band at their peak, just living in excess, creating amazing songs. But
taking acid for the first
time. There wouldn't have an edge to it. There wouldn't be a, ooh, this is a band teetering
on
the edge.
There's a poignancy, isn't there, knowing that this is the last time they'll be in the studio together. Yeah. This is the last time John and Paul are going to be singing to each other through gritted teeth.
Yeah.
This is the last time that George is going to have a hissy fit. This is the last time they're going to play live. Like, there is that real poignancy. A question I had for you as a musician, because this is one of the things that I don't understand about music. You know, when people talk about bands, you know, like Oasis, their songs all sound the same. They're built off the same four chords or whatever it is. Could you say that about the Beatles, or are they legitimately diverse?
I think
in their
I think
albums? They don't have a formula.
But I think you know the answer to this question, really. Certainly. Sorry about
what was that?
It's the drilling upstairs on the roof.
Okay, that's all right. Well, we can wind it
no,
up soon. But just answer
this
question.
Yeah, it's just
first.
Noel Gallagher himself has never understood the comparison.
Right.
Noel Gallagher himself has never understood the comparison. I'm just trying to get the gaps with the drilling. Noel is a simple songwriter. He's got an idea and he wants to deliver it as big and loud as possible. But your Beatles, the diversity of tunes, the diversity of genres, that they just wanted to make good songs. And there was no other agenda than to sell records. And I mean, they were competing all the time with groups like the Beach Boys and stuff, you know, because that was their language. Everyone wants to be the best at what they do, you know. So they used competition as a real motivator, which everyone does.
Yeah.
But I think musically, just watching Paul go from, you know, bass to drums to piano, and all of them do that. All of them just do that. Their job is to make music. But what they've got over every other band is the music they're making is better than any other band. Really.
Gatesy, thank you so much for coming on FOFOP. This is the last FOFOP for 2021. Oh. I thought I'd go out in a bang with a big guest talking about the biggest band in the world.
Prepare for the spike.
Let's do it again, though. Like, you've got me. I mean, you're so good at this stuff. I want to get you back on, and maybe we can do a deeper dive on this, or maybe we can talk about another band or another album or something. Because this is, I find this so educational, and it's just so great having your perspective.
Oh, thanks,
on this.
Charlie.
Do you have anything you need to promote? Are you guys doing any shows coming up in the new year?
We're doing a spot at the Sunday ESPY comedy this Sunday.
this won't be coming out till next week.
No, exactly. Tripod, we've Jon, he had a bee in his bonnet about putting all of our stuff, video, DVD, albums, you know, we've released about 14, you know, releases over the years. And he wanted to put it all on a USB stick, and it's called the Shtick of Tripod. And it's like it's like an NFT, but real, and everyone can own it. And probably it's already on the internet anyway. I don't know.
So nothing like an NFT.
No, but if you go to our website, threepod.com.au, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff there that you can get involved with, but it's just been a weird year in terms of we are completely, we're unable to discern what the future has or what it is. You know, the idea of pivoting to an online thing is not it's not interesting to me at all. I'd rather deliver milk, you know. Actually, yeah. I don't think that is even a thing anymore. but yeah, it's an interesting time.
Before you change careers from successful comedian into milkman, we'll have to get you back on FOFOP. But for now, everyone, have a great, happy and safe Christmas and New Year. I'm Charlie Clawson.
And I'm Stephen Gates.
I hope we pass the audition.